Thank you, choir, and thank you, Marilyn, for always accompanying our choir. And Chip's right, while June was playing, I was singing all of those. Except Chip kept on leaning over, going, shh, be quiet. Kind of hurtful, but anyway. So we continue our series on modern family, and today's message is called Adolescence. And I have to state right up front that this message ended up going in a decidedly different direction than I had when I planned it several weeks ago. After I'd done the research, I came away with a completely different view. And then I realized also, as I was doing the research and thinking and reflecting, that there's also a message in this that all of us need to hear, whether and it's a message that has a little to do with parenting and adolescence or anything like that. So today, before we gather around the Lord's table, I'm actually going to give you three messages. I'm going to give you the message I was intending to give long ago, and then I'm going to give you the message that the research ended up pointing me towards. And then I'm going to give you the third message, the one that has to do with our own spiritual lives, and that'll help prepare us to receive the Lord's Supper. Don't worry, they're not each 20-minute messages, all right? As you can imagine, when we think about the term adolescence, it's not a nice term. It's not a term that was coined with the intention of being complimentary. I didn't coin it. It's actually a terminology that's being thrown about out there. It describes young adults who refuse to grow up, who are extending adolescence well into their 20s, and they're doing so because they've been rather coddled all of their lives by their parents. These are the adults who are the result of the kidolatry that I spoke about last week. So these are people in their 20s who still live with their parents, oftentimes even after college. They all took majors that didn't necessarily prepare them for the workplace. And so they hop from low-paying job to low-paying job, which is fine with them because mom and dad are still providing almost everything that they really need. So all they really need a job for is money to spend on, you know, video games and the latest iPhone and going out with their friends, eating out and partying with their friends and stuff. And it's friends that they have, because they also don't want the responsibility of a committed relationship. Certainly they don't want the responsibility of raising children, at least not yet. Their viewpoint is, we're young now, so now is the time to have fun. Why put off having fun to retirement when they're not even sure that retirement's going to happen for them, first of all? But also when your health might prevent you from having a good time. So do it now, is their thinking. Have fun now. Enjoy life now before the weight of all this responsibility comes crashing down on you. Now, typical of this is a young man described in an article who's named Matt. He's 27 years old. He took 6.5 years to graduate from college. With a degree in cognitive science. And he's in no hurry to pursue adult responsibilities like home ownership and marriage and parenting. He said, I don't even want a lawn. I don't want to be a parent. I mean, why would I? There's so much fun to be had while you're young. Or there's 26-year-old Jenny who said, I want to get married, but not soon. I'm enjoying myself. There is a lot I want to do by myself still. Now, it's at this point where we tend to get a little judgy, right? We kind of shake our heads and what's wrong with these young people today, you know, and their self-absorption and stuff. And I have to admit, this is as I got closer and closer to this message, it's for this reason that I became more and more uncomfortable with having to give this particular message. It just started to feel more and more icky, you know? Ickier? I don't know. I don't know how you would phrase that. But I kept feeling like that we would be sitting around, you know, kind of being smug about how much better we are than those young slackers out there. I mean, Pam and I were married at 21, and we moved to seminary where Pam worked full-time, and I went to school full-time, worked part-time jobs. At one time, I was going to school full-time and working 3 part-time jobs. And we didn't put off having children just because we were in school. We had Angela at 25 and Austin at 29. And you can all tell similar type of stories, most of you. And it's easy to say, you know, like I said, what's wrong with these young people? I mean, and the thing is that Jesus battled judgmentalism his entire ministry. And it felt like I'd be giving a message that would lead us all to be judgmental, and largely about people who aren't even in the room. You know, we'd be kind of be like talking bad about them behind their backs. And that's the other icky part, that we'd be talking about them behind their backs, because adolescents don't go to church all that much. And so as I did research, and I among the research I did was look at how other pastors handled this topic and read other sermons and stuff, and I found that the typical sermon dealing with adolescents kind of followed a pattern. First, there was a not-so-kind, rather condescending description of what I just gave of these young people, and this was followed by some quite frankly questionable use of scripture to kind of support their points, and then some advice to young people who weren't even there, and the advice basically was stop it. You know, that was basically it. Stop it. Stop doing that. Stop being so self-absorbed. You know, as if 20-somethings are the only age group that's self-absorbed, right? And as if we weren't also self-absorbed in our 20s as well. And so, yeah, I saw a lot of these sermons, and they just felt very pointless and very judgmental, and I wasn't comfortable about that. And then I found out that I didn't have to be. The more research I did, the more I found that many, not all, but many people in their 20s, what they're doing is actually a very mature response to a very modern, complicated world. They're growing up in a world that we did not grow up in. There's an article that came out not too long ago on the Washington Post, just 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact, and noted that that young people were putting off marriage. And from the outside, it looks as if that they don't put a high value on marriage. And that's why they were putting it off. But in fact, it was just the opposite. Young people are delaying marriage because they place a high value on marriage. There are 2 things that went into this. One, we have to remember that today's 20-somethings came of age right about the time that we had the worst economic downturn since the Depression. They graduated from college with more debt than most of us had until we bought our first house. And then they tried to enter into a job market in which not only was experience required, but there were plenty of people out there looking for jobs who had lots and lots of experience. And I saw this firsthand with Angela. She is the least slacky person you'll ever want to meet. I'm just making up words as I go along here, slacky. But she really is. She graduated from the University of Maryland, a very good university. And she had to take a job at a daycare because there were no jobs in her field that were available to her. She moved home, lived with us for a little while she was doing that. Then after a couple of years, she took a job as a nanny and started. But while she was doing that, she started working on her master's degree. Not one master's degree, but two master's degrees. And she did that for a while, and then she was able to finally find a low-paying job in her field. And she now has a master's degree in nonprofit management and an MBA. And she's in a better job in her field, and she's positioned in the next couple of years to move up into management. She was married almost exactly a year ago at the age of 30. And she's not a slacker. It's just the world is very, very different. And the second reason that young people are delaying marriage is not just because of the economics of becoming an adult. Because more and more of them value it very highly, and they see divorce as an unacceptable response to marital strain. Listen to this. In 2002, when they surveyed about this stuff, in 2002, 50% of Americans disagreed with the statement, divorce is usually the best solution when a couple can't seem to work out their marriage problems. Half of adults agreed, half of adults disagreed. Within 10 years, the percentage of Americans, of adults, who disagreed with that statement had risen to 60%, with young people being the demographic that was the most opposed to divorce as a response to marital strain. And I remember reading that thinking, well, that's admirable, you know? That's a mature response. A lot of them grew up as the children of divorce, and they're like, we are not going to do that. So we're not going to jump in before we're financially ready. We're not going to jump in until we know that this person is the right person, and we can make this work. We're not going to do that to ourselves and to our children. And so they're waiting. See, for a lot of us, marriage was seen as the foundational event of an adult life. You found a mate, you got married, and then together you struggled through the economic uncertainty as, you know, you went to school and you built a career, and the capstone event when you got to really enjoy life was retirement. You know, you worked all your life and then you finally achieved that. Young people don't want that strain on their marriage. They're willing to struggle, but they'd rather do it while they're single. And then after they've established themselves, maybe even after they've bought their first home, then they feel comfortable getting married and then having children. And so marriage and having children became not for them the foundational, the first event of adulthood, but the capstone, the thing they were driving towards. Rather than retirement as the capstone event, the getting married and having a family became the capstone event, the event that they were driving towards and sacrificing for right now while they are single. And you may disagree with that approach, and you may not understand that approach, but you got to admit it's a mature response to a complex world. And we're finding that people who marry later have more stable marriages. According to one New York Times article, on average, each year that young people postpone marriage right up into their mid-30s lowers their chance of divorce. And each year a woman delays motherhood leads to improved test scores for her children. So, rather than be judgy on them, let's give them the kudos they deserve. Even if not the path that we would have chosen for them. I mean, Pam and I thought, when my dad was my age, he had four grandchildren. You know, we don't have any grandchildren. Pam and I thought by this time we'd have some grandchildren, you know. We would have chosen a different path for our kids. By the time, you know, we had two kids by the time we were Angela's age. By the time we were Austin's age, Pam was pregnant with Austin. You know, we were on our way. But they've chosen a different path, and they've chosen it for some good reasons. And that's message two. Okay? That's the second message that I want us to hear. But then I thought about the first message that I gave. That self-absorbed, you know, pleasure, fun-seeking millennial. And then I kind of realized that, you know, spiritually at least, that's not just something that people in their 20s and early 30s do. That self-absorption, that fun-seeking, pleasure-seeking the thing in a spiritual sense is something that's afflicted Christians throughout the ages. It afflicts all humans. I call it spiritual adolescence. And you can see it in all age groups from the oldest to the youngest. So there's a high cost of spiritual adolescence. I thought about this a couple of weeks ago. Pam and I were watching a video of Don Ortberg as he was speaking about spiritual transformation in people's lives. And in the video, he asked, what are a two-year-old's two most favorite words? Y'all know? What's a two-year-old's first favorite word? No, exactly. What's their second favorite word? Mine, all right? No, mine. No, mine. You know, they're really, really good at saying that. And Ortberg brought that up because he said that these are the two attitudes that underlie our greatest spiritual sins. Saying no to God and saying mine to the world. No to God and mine to the world. The process of spiritual formation or spiritual growth, whatever you want to call it, it's the process in which we learn to say yes to God and no to our selfish desires. And we stop saying mine to the world and we learn to say ours. Right? We learn to share. In other words, we learn that we are all interconnected and we stop violating others in order to protect what is mine. We learn to give ourselves away. And in doing so, in giving ourselves away, we find ourselves. But we have too many spiritual adult lessons in our churches. Christians who've been born again but never made it much out of grade school. And this isn't a new problem. This is a problem that the writers of the New Testament were dealing with and address over and over. The writer of Hebrews said to his congregation in Hebrews 5, 12 through 14, he said, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic elements of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who lives on milk, still being an infant, is unskilled in the word of righteousness, but solid food is for the mature, for those whose faculties have been trained by practice to distinguish good and evil. And if you look at the context, the writer of Hebrews is dealing with people who are unwilling to be obedient to God because it would have meant sacrificing the good life that they had worked so hard to achieve, that they had earned. And they wanted the good life according to material things, but they also wanted to be saved. In other words, they wanted it all. And the writer of Hebrews points out that we are saved not by trying to have our way, but by giving ourselves, giving of ourselves. This is what Jesus said, did he said. And thus in Hebrews 5:8, before we got to those verses about milk and meat, he says, although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. It's a great verse. Although he was a son, in other words, in all the, although he had everything, everything was under his power, he learned obedience, turning a no into a yes to God through what he suffered. In other words, by pouring out his life for the world. And folks, that's not milk. That's the meat of the gospel. That's what spiritual maturity is all about. And that's what's represented here at the Lord's table. As we gather around this table, we gather around a table that represents the Son of God who emptied himself and became human, became obedient unto death, even death on the cross. He sacrificed so that we could enter into his kingdom. So we celebrate, we remember, and we also recommit to that very kind of life. So let's gather around the Lord's table.